It's Thursday, October 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, Congress gets set to vote on a formal impeachment investigation resolution.
When our founders drafted the Constitution more than 230 years ago, they included a process that could lead to removing a president from office if he or she abused their power.
Also ahead, nations meet in Geneva to work on a new Syrian constitution. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands have fled Syria to escape Turkish troops. Chile cancels the APEC conference, and just in time for Halloween, we'll visit a special exhibit dedicated to the natural history of horror on today's International Edition. Democratic and Republican House lawmakers heard fresh testimony Wednesday about the Trump administration's unusual back channels to Ukraine as part of the impeachment investigation underway on Capitol Hill. Two State Department Ukraine experts offered new accounts of President Trump's reliance on his personal attorney Rudy Giuliani rather than career diplomats to engage with the East European ally, a struggling democracy facing aggression from Russia. Foreign Service Officer Christopher Anderson testified that National Security Advisor John Bolton cautioned him that Giuliani, quote, was a key voice with the president on Ukraine and could complicate U.S. goals for the country. Another Foreign Service officer, Catherine Croft, said that during her time at the White House's National Security Council, she received multiple phone calls from lobbyist Robert Livingston, a former top Republican lawmaker, once in line to become House Speaker, telling her the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, should be fired. Later today, the full House of Representatives will vote on a formal impeachment investigation resolution. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the vote also sets the stage for the impeachment inquiry to go public.
This is a sad day.
A new phase in the investigation that could lead to the impeachment of President Trump.
That as much as this president flaunts the Constitution, we are going to protect it.
House Democrats have been investigating the president in closed House Intelligence Committee hearings since last month when a whistleblower alleged the president held up $400 million in congressionally approved U.S. aid to Ukraine to pressure Ukraine to gather dirt on political rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter.
This Department of Justice refused to do an investigation into the alleged misconduct and criminal operations of the executive branch of government. Therefore, it was left to the legislative branch to do it.
With Thursday's vote on a resolution that lays out rules for the impeachment inquiry, Speaker Pelosi takes a key argument away from Republicans who say Trump is the victim of an illegitimate investigation.
They're now attempting to sort of put a cloak of legitimacy around this process by saying they're going to bring it to a vote on the floor. They can't fix it. The process is broken. It's tainted.
House Democrats caution this is not a vote impeaching President Trump, but a step in the investigation that will allow for public hearings.
We will continue to proceed in a serious, solemn, and somber fashion. That's what the Constitution requires at this moment. House Democrats will continue to follow the facts, apply the law, be guided by the Constitution, and present the truth to the American people.
But the vote will not change the deep divide over impeachment.
This is nothing more than a fishing expedition to see if they can't uncover something else that might be useful to them should the whistleblower complaint fail.
Some people call it a fishing expedition like you. Others call it congressional oversight.
Or the White House position on the investigation, says one analyst.
The vote is going to have no effect on the White House's position in an effort to block witnesses from appearing before House committees. The White House had suggested early on that they were blocking witnesses because this was not a formal inquiry, but that was really just window dressing. Ultimately, what this could do is strengthen House Democrats' position in the courts as they ask for subpoenas to be enforced.
Public hearings are likely to begin in mid-November. In the meantime, House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff plans to call a key witness for classified testimony. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Among the top stories in the world, Pentagon releases video, photos of Baghdadi raid. NATO chief warns calls for Russia troop withdrawal from Ukraine. Syria's warring parties meet to draft new constitution. Chile cancels APEC COP25 amid ongoing protests. New wind-driven wildfire erupts in Southern California. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Syrian government and opposition delegates have begun meeting to draft a new constitution as a prelude to UN-supervised elections for their war-torn country. UN mediator Geir Pedersen calls the meeting of Syria's arch-enemies an historic moment. At the official launch of the Syrian Constitutional Committee Wednesday, he welcomed members with words of encouragement and urged them to strive for a durable solution to years of division and suffering.
Members of the committee, I know that it is not easy for all of you to be here together in this room, and I respect that. I know that there are deep feelings among you, reflecting the deep feelings among all Syrians about the state of their beloved country after nearly 9 years of violent conflict.
Pedersen says the first gathering of the Committee of 150 government, opposition, and civil society members brings together diverse religious and ethnic backgrounds, as well as a wide spectrum of political leanings. He added that the varied composition of views and beliefs presents difficulties as well as opportunities for meaningful change.
But the fact that you are here today, sitting together face to face, ready to start a dialogue and negotiations, is, I believe, a powerful sign of hope for Syrians everywhere, both inside and outside the country.
Pedersen said it will be difficult to reconcile so many divergent views, especially when the risks and dangers of military escalation in Syria remain a daily threat. He promised UN help to facilitate the process every step along a difficult path. Pedersen's words were greeted with professions of goodwill from the warring parties. Syrian government co-chair of the committee, Ahmad Kuzbari, noted that a constitution is the cornerstone and solid building block on which states are built. He says his delegation is prepared to consider possible amendments to Syria's existing constitution, but he added that the process must safeguard the country's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity with no outside interference in internal affairs. Syrian opposition co-chair Hadi al-Bahara says that Syrians seek a nation that respects all people without discrimination. He said that the only victory that is worth having is one based on justice and peace, not on one side winning the war. Such a victory, he warned, is not sustainable. The United Nations reports that hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Syria's long-running civil war. It says that 6.7 million people have fled as refugees to other countries, and 6.2 million are displaced within Syria. In a related story, the UN Refugee Agency reports that more than 12,000 Syrian refugees have fled to Iraq in less than 2 weeks to escape Turkey's military onslaught in Kurdish-controlled areas of northeastern Syria. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports it is scaling up its humanitarian operation in Iraq in response to the deepening humanitarian refugee crisis on both sides of the Syrian-Iraqi border. The UNHCR says since the last influx of Syrian refugees nearly 2 weeks ago, more than 12,000 people have crammed into the recently opened Badr Rush camp. More than 800 other refugees are sheltering at the Gawilan transit site. It notes both places are about 150 kilometers east of the border. UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mehecic says his agency is working with Iraqi authorities to reunite the newly arrived refugees with family members living in Iraq's Kurdistan region.
UNHCR is supporting the response led by the local authorities, and it is working closely with them to ready other locations in the event that both sites reach their capacity. Refugee families at both locations are receiving the same services and humanitarian assistance. This includes hot meals, transportation, registration, shelter, and protection services.
Turkey began its so-called Operation Peace Spring against Kurdish-led forces in Syria on October 9th. The offensive began after the U.S. Trump administration announced it was withdrawing U.S. troops who have been allied with the Syrian Kurds in the region. The Kurds, who have lost thousands of people in fighting against Islamic State militants, have accused Washington of betraying them. The UNHCR reports nearly 180,000 Syrian Kurds, including some 80,000 children, have been displaced since the start of the Turkish assault. Dozens of civilians reportedly have been killed. The UN estimates 1.3 million people in the region are in need of humanitarian assistance. The UN Refugee Agency reports women and children comprise around three-quarters of the Syrian refugees in the two campsites in Iraq. It says many are in need of psychosocial counseling. UNHCR spokesman Mahecic says agency teams are conducting protection monitoring, child protection, and working to identify unaccompanied children and people with specific needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Officials at the White House were caught by surprise with Chile's announcement Wednesday that it is canceling two summits, including one that President Donald Trump was to attend next month, where he was to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping and other leaders. Chilean President Sebastián Piñera announced Wednesday that due to continuing anti-government protests in Santiago, his country will no longer host the Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in mid-November, as well as the COP25 Climate Summit in early December. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman about what the cancellation means for U.S.-China policy and the ongoing trade war.
Well, what we know, Ira, is there's not going to be a meeting between President Trump and President Xi in Santiago next month, and that's because of the announcement by the Chilean President Sebastián Piñera that the APEC summit, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting, is not going to be held there because of the situation on the ground in Santiago, where there's been an anti-government protests going on for some weeks and has been violent at times. So if they are going to meet, it's going to be somewhere else.
Has there been any notification from the White House, or at least any indication from the White House what might happen next?
Well, the White House was caught by surprise that the APEC summit was being canceled. There's not a secondary site prepared. The White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley, who I spoke to a couple of times today, said that the administration's awaiting potential information regarding another location. And he said that the White House is still looking forward to finalizing what the president's called phase one of what would be, in the views of the president, a historic trade deal with China within the same time frame. And he says, when we have an announcement, we'll let you know. So everything basically is up in the air right now.
Do you think there is any way that those involved can find a secondary gathering for this meeting, which had been postponed anyway? It was originally scheduled for Brazil, and it was moved to Chile.
Right. It's looking like it's a very low possibility that we're going to see an APEC summit next month. What is possible is that President Xi and President Trump will meet somewhere. The APEC summit was ideal because this would take place on the sidelines. It's a neutral turf. It's not President Xi coming to the U.S. or President Trump going to China. And we could see something like we viewed a couple of times with President Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, where they met in a third country. But that was a more elaborate event. We're not expecting anything quite that elaborate because it appears that the Chinese weren't looking to make a huge deal out of signing a partial trade agreement. But one thing we've seen, Ira, in this White House, things can change very quickly. The president can be impulsive. I'm talking about the U.S. president, and could get on the phone with President Xi and work something out on short notice.
That's VOA's Ira Melman speaking with Steve Herman at the White House. On Wednesday, security forces in Chile trained water cannon and tear gas on demonstrators as the unrest that has gripped the country for almost 2 weeks showed no sign of slowing. Drone video showed protesters once again taking to the streets of the capital, Santiago. The unrest started as a minor protest over a small increase in subway fares, but it has turned into a national movement for greater equality and better public services. Coming up, we'll visit a special exhibit in Courage. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and next week, I would like to invite you to join Border Crossings for a special broadcast just for you. We'll be bringing you one of the greatest music producers in American pop music, Nile Rodgers. Listen to Border Crossings to hear the best songs from some of the greats like Chic, Madonna, David Bowie, and Daft Punk, all with one thing in common, produced by Nile Rodgers. Don't miss this great program next week at 1500 Universal, right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm David Byrd in Washington. President Donald Trump presented the nation's highest military honor Wednesday to a Green Beret who helped save four critically wounded comrades and prevented the lead element of a special operations force from being overrun in Afghanistan. Master Sergeant Matthew O. Williams of Texas still serves in the U.S. Army. The events leading to the honor occurred in April 2008 during a mountainside firefight that lasted several hours as Williams's team and about 100 Afghan commandos were attacked by insurgents waiting above them.
The lead group was 60 feet up the slope when roughly 200 insurgents savagely attacked, and it was a big surprise. Very unwelcome surprise, I might add. The terrorists filled the valley with a hail of bullets and explosions. Matt soon received word that the soldiers on the mountain were pinned down and suffering from mounting casualties.
President Trump recounted how Williams led the commandos across a fast-moving and icy river and engaged the enemy. When his team sergeant was wounded by a sniper, Williams exposed himself to enemy fire to come to his aid. He helped to evacuate the sergeant and then climbed back up the mountain to evacuate others, again exposing himself to enemy fire as he helped carry and load others onto evacuation helicopters.
Matt raced back into battle. He fought for several more hours, valiantly protecting the wounded and putting his own life in great peril to save his comrades. Matt's incredible heroism helped ensure that not a single American soldier died in the Battle of Shock Valley.
The ceremony in the White House East Room included lawmakers from Williams's home state of Texas, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, and the nation's top military leaders. For his part, Sergeant Williams said he was humbled by the whole experience and thanked his fellow soldiers. He said they trusted one another, fought hard together, and believed in one another. And that was why they were all able to come home. While Sergeant Williams's courage earned him the Medal of Honor, other military veterans' courage is part of a unique display here in Washington at the Kennedy Center. The arts venue opened an unusual exhibition within the walls of its new space, a collection of portraits by former President George W. Bush. Maxine Moskalkov has the story.
Portraits of Courage, a collection of 66 oil paintings of military veterans. The artist, former U.S. President George W. Bush. The works are on exhibit at the Washington Kennedy Center.
President Bush painted each one of these. It took him about a year to paint all of them. But really what we're here to talk about is not the great challenges they've all faced, and they've all faced tremendous challenge, but it's the resilience and continued leadership that they display on a daily basis.
Skilled and leadership. After leaving the presidency in 2009, Bush dedicated himself to U.S. war and army veterans. The ex-president organized golf and mountain bike tournaments for former military personnel.
I've served in the military for 24 years. I'm a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. On July 27th, 2007, I was severely wounded in Iraq. Lost my right leg. Had the opportunity through that experience to join one of President Bush's, actually two of President Bush's mountain bike events that he has at Crawford Ranch. So that's where it started, and got to know the president over those two events. And consequently ended up doing the portrait behind us.
Bush says he tries to portray the character, his way of showing respect to the veterans through art. The former president personally knows each person portrayed in his work.
So many people who can say they had their portrait painted by an actual president of the United States. And it represents my service. I mean, I've served for 40 years now, and I'm up there with a lot of people I know. It's an honor to sit on that portrait and have people comment about it.
Brian Flom suffered a head wound during a 2007 missile strike in Iraq. His physical recovery was relatively quick, but it took years to get past his psychological wounds and PTSD. Flom took up mountain biking as therapy.
One year I applied to ride mountain bikes with President Bush, and I was selected, and I've done that for a couple years, and Got more involved with the Bush Institute, and here I am on a mural painted by President Bush.
Army Major Christopher Turner says George W. Bush's events helped him open up and start talking about his military experience.
He painted two portraits of me. So there's one down the other end with a much darker look, much darker background. My face is kind of, I almost look dead inside in the portrait. And that one behind me right now, that's the real me. The one on the end is the guy that I don't ever want to be again.
The former president's works are the subject of a 2017 book titled Portraits of Courage, a Commander-in-Chief's Tribute to America's Warriors. In the book, each portrait is accompanied by the former president's story about each veteran. Profits from book sales go to the Military Service Initiative, a Bush Institute organization that helps military veterans transition back to civilian life as smoothly as possible. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
The total of 66 oil paintings, known as Portraits of Courage, will be displayed at the Kennedy Center through November 15th. To see some of these portraits, check out our website, voanews.com. Today, October 31st, marks Halloween, or All Hallows' Eve in many countries. It's a time when ghosts and ghouls and monsters, or at least people dressed like them, go door to door asking for candy. Dracula, Frankenstein, and other monsters may have literary origins, but Hollywood has made them iconic characters that have scared and thrilled audiences around the world. Filmmakers look to science and archaeology as inspiration for their movie monsters. The connection between science and art is now on display at an exhibit called The Natural History of Horror at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Elizabeth Lee has details.
A step into this space takes guests back in time to a period where Hollywood created hair-raising horrors that have lasted through the years.
It's really been a journey since those films were created to see
how these different monsters have been interpreted and reinterpreted over the years.
When you look at, for instance, Dracula, all you have to do is see a man in a cape and a tuxedo underneath. It's an iconic image. You know it's the suave, sophisticated Dracula during the day and a vampire at night. You look at Frankenstein and the green makeup and the flat head and the bolts coming out of the neck. You know what you're looking at.
Guests can see original monster movie props donated by Universal, including the ball and chain that shackled Frankenstein's monster. There is also a reproduction of the 1954 film Creature from the Black Lagoon costume and gills that moved. Beyond the props, this exhibit also shows the reality that inspired these Hollywood horrors. Millicent Patrick designed this creature by looking at reptiles, amphibians, fish, and pictures of extinct animals for inspiration. One of the origins of this monster came from the discovery of the coelacanth in 1938. At the time, some biologists thought this fish was the missing link between sea and land creatures. Another movie monster highlighted here is the mummy. The wrappings of a real mummy is displayed near the fake wrappings of the 1932 movie The Mummy, inspired by the discovery of King Tutankhamun's tomb.
The prop is pretty much what the originals were made out of, linen cloth, very coarsely woven, and in our case, with the prop mummy wrappings, they were dubbed with Fuller's Earth to give them kind of that dusty, crusty look to age them. It's kind of like a dirt-like mixture that you would use when you wanted to age something or have something look dusty. As a matter of fact, it was used also in the makeup for Boris Karloff in The Mummy.
When it comes to Dracula, the prop for the vampire bat is on display along with the real bat and information on how Europeans used to think vampires caused various types of diseases. These monsters may look different and have different origin stories, but they share a common thread in the films.
What it really encompasses is characters that all they really want is to be loved. Because you see Dracula, you see Frankenstein, you see the mummy, you see Bride of Frankenstein, and it's characters that just want to be accepted. And I think that's just a universal theme that audiences identify with.
That may be one of the reasons why filmmakers keep making monster movies over the years, inspired by these Hollywood horrors. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
A fire has destroyed much of Shuri Castle, a World Heritage Site on Japan's southern island of Okinawa, with its main hall reduced to a skeleton. Television footage showed firefighters still battling flames at the multi-structured wooden castle early this morning. The public broadcaster NHK said emergency responders received the first call about the fire around 17 hours 47 UTC. A popular tourist attraction, Shuri was built more than 500 years ago as the royal castle of the Ryukyu Kingdom. The fire tore through the castle in the middle of its annual mid-autumn festival. It had been scheduled to be included as a stop on the 2020 Tokyo Olympic torch relay route. Located on a hilltop overlooking the city of Naha and enclosed by curved stone walls, the castle and its surrounding structures were painted a vivid red and recognized by their sloped tile roofs. It had been destroyed and rebuilt after many fires, most recently in the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. And an earthquake with a magnitude of 6.5 struck 37 kilometers west of Davao, Philippines, at a depth of about 22 kilometers, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Thursday's tremor was in the same area where a strong tremor killed at least six people on Tuesday. The USGS had originally said the quake had a magnitude of 6.8, but there was no threat of a tsunami. And the Washington Nationals have beaten the Houston Astros 6-2 to win Major League Baseball's World Series in Houston 4-3. It is the first World Series title for a Washington baseball team since 1924. You've been listening to the VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and to our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.